the event back over to Dave F.
Give me one more second, and I'll be with you guys. I just got to figure out how to get this back up on my screen. Boom. Down. That's what I'm looking for. There we go. Cool. So how's everybody doing this morning? Awesome. I'm thrilled to be with you this morning, and we're going to have some fun today. So we're going to touch some things inside of you. we're going to touch some things inside of you today that probably most of you have not not thought about having touched. And it's always a hoot when we do this this kind of work. anybody have an emotional hangover this morning?
A little bit.
A little bit, yeah, I warned you. It'll get worse, you know, before it gets better. Before I forget, I made some stickers for you guys. Feel free to come up and stick them in your big book. This is what I want, doesn't matter. I don't get a vote because I work for God today. I have a laminated card that says patience, tolerance, kindness, and love, and it has that quote underneath it, and it sits on my desk at my house on purpose because I need a constant reminder. I've also got just plain old what I want doesn't matter. So you can stick those. I have one of those stuck next to my odometer on my car, you know, just as a little subtle reminder, because I don't know about you, but I have a problem driving. you know, I have a constant, my wife will testify this, I have a constant discussion, if you want to call it that, passionate discussion with the other drivers on the road. So where did we leave off yesterday? We left off pretty much, we got up to step 12. I've been talking about step 12 this entire conference, about how I do this work, why I do this work, the way I do this work. So the one thing that I do that I didn't do, you know how when I get to the construction reference, I stop them having to go to the page 75 and put the construction references. When we get to page 18, I have them jump ahead to working with others, and on working with others, I have them write in this quote, C18:4. Because this is a critical, important piece for 12-step work. It says, but the ex-problem drinker who has found the solution, that's me, who is properly armed with the facts about himself, that's me, can generally win the entire confidence of another alcoholic in a few hours. Until such an understanding is reached, little or nothing can be accomplished. So until you convince the guy that you're trying to help that you know what the hell you're talking about, you're wasting your breath. Because I think I mentioned this, you know, the alcoholic battle cry. Okay, you just don't understand. I'm different. That's our battle cry. We've all done it, and we still do it in sobriety. Yeah, I get it. You know, when somebody comes to us and tries to talk to us, you know, that maybe quitting your job and moving to Eastern Slobobia because, you know, you met a girl online, it's probably not a good idea. You're like, yeah, I know that. You know, that we still do it today, even in sobriety when we're off the beam. You know, I just have them write that up on that page, C18:4, because this is the first instruction when it comes to working with others. The 12 and 12, and I haven't gone into the 12 and 12 very much. Bill Wilson wrote the book, and then it was like 15 years later that he wrote the traditions, and then he wrote the concepts, and he was working on the world service structure, and he wanted to get the information out, and they said, well, Bill, nobody's willing to buy a book on that. Alcoholics are way too self-centered, and they're not going to do that. So he had started to write a series of essays on the 12 steps that they were getting printed by the Grapevine articles. And so what he said is, I know what alcoholics will do. They want essays on the 12 steps. So he created a book and put the 12 essays that he wrote for the Grapevine article and then added in the traditions behind it, you know. And that's what we have, the 12 and 12. But the difference was, on page 17 of the 12 and 12, it says the purpose of the 12 and 12. It says that those essays are to expand what's in the original text, which is in our big book. I see people all the time that try to work the steps out of the 12 and 12. That is not an easy thing to do. As a matter of fact, if you read, for example, look at step 4 in the 12 and 12 sometime. What does it start out with? Sex. Sex inventory. Why? Because that's what Bill Wilson was dealing with. The story goes is that he was having an affair with his secretary at the time, and Father Ed Dowling had pulled him up sharply about that, said, you can't be a spiritual man and be doing that behavior, you know, and so they had done some spiritual work on that. So what was on his mind when he wrote that essay was where he currently was in his life at that time, you know. But what about the resentment inventory? What about the fear inventory? You know, there's so much more meat in the big book. So there are some passages that are really, really good for the 12 and 12. And here's some of them. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result, J.R. brought that up last night in his talk. There's one result. The whole reason we're here is to have one outcome. And it has nothing to do with drinking. It's to have a spiritual awakening, to wake your spirit up so that you can be effective for God. Right? We tried to carry this message to alcoholics and practice these principles in all our affairs. So 12 and 12 says, our 12th step also says that the results of practicing all of the steps, we have found something called a spiritual awakening. The spiritual awakening comes when you practice all of the steps. And you heard me talking about prayer and meditation. I can't tell you how many people I run into that pray, but they don't meditate. I mentioned Marine Bob yesterday, the guy after 29 and a half years, he relapsed. It's a miracle that guy's back. And the one thing he'll tell you that he does differently now, because he was going to meetings, he was sponsoring, he was doing all the things you're supposed to do. He drifted away from the program and he wasn't meditating. He was still saying his prayers, but meditation has become key in his life, and he's on fire. It's a whole different guy. It's an amazing deal. From 106:1, here we begin to practice all 12 steps of the program in our daily lives so that we and those about us may find emotional sobriety. Do you see what I said there? So that we and those about us, by us practicing the 12 steps, the people around us, the people closest to us, the ones we hurt the most, are able to find emotional sobriety. If I get off the spiritual beam, if I don't say my morning prayer and meditation, my wife knows it in a nanosecond. You know, because she'll look at me and go, did you say your prayers this morning? You know, any good Al-Anon has got the Al-Anon radar, and they know how we're feeling before we do. You know, they can anticipate that, right? The next quote, so practicing these steps, we had a spiritual awakening about which finally there was no question. Are you sure about whether you've had a spiritual awakening? If you haven't, grab somebody that's been through this work who can guide you and walk through it with you and have the awakening. And if you haven't, it's nothing, you didn't do anything wrong. It's just you haven't had the right teachers. Now that you got the right teachers, go have the experience. There is nothing cooler than when your spirit wakes up and you kind of go, whoa, that's awesome. And then you kind of, at least if you're like me, I got kind of angry. I went through kind of a militant phase because it's like, well, why isn't everybody doing this? What's wrong with everybody? Hey, come on, you know, and I want to start smacking people up by the side of the head with the big book going, you know, you're missing the whole deal. This is the real meat over here. But they're on their own path. We're not in charge. We don't get a vote, right? We just work with the ones we can. I was talking with Cody from Seattle, and I said to him, you know, I get asked to do workshops and go places and do things all the time because my tapes are all over the damn world now, you know, especially with YouTube and all that stuff. So people are always calling up saying, hey, would you come do a workshop? And God has put it on my heart to ask them some questions. I don't just go ahead and say, sure, I'll come over and do a workshop. I need to find out, are they serious? Are they worth my investment of time? And what I'm looking to do is affect people that have the willingness, it's in all 12 steps, willingness, that have the willingness to go out and carry this message in your local. I'm looking to plant the seed for a pocket of enthusiasm. That's somebody that's worth my time. You know, everybody wants you to come do a workshop, you know, because they got a weekend and they got a committee that'll throw a host it. But a lot of times you can do that and nothing happens. You don't see any change in that area. But if you find some people that are truly willing and you give them your time, you take them through the work and say, hey, let's do the work together. And they're saying, yeah, I'm ready to do that. I'd love to do that. And then they say, hey, would you come to a workshop? You know, that's a place you can go and make an investment because it's going to pay off after generation after generation. The reason I work so hard at this is I want it to be available for my kids and my grandkids, you know?
What kind of questions do you ask?
I started asking them about their prayer and meditation life and what kind of service work do they do? I need to find out if they're in the trenches. How many sponsees do you have? You know, how long have you had them is a key question. Because if they say, well, I've had six or seven guys for the last 10 years, and I'm like, well, how many new guys you got? And they go, well, I don't think I have anybody new. There's a warning sign right there. Well, why don't they have anybody new? Why haven't they? One of my jobs when I work with guys is I take them through the work really quick. Then I take them through a second time. Then I teach them the traditions and the concepts and the history stuff, give them those exercises. But by the time I'm giving them those exercises, I've kicked them out of the nest. They're gone. I don't have time to wipe their asses and, you know, and I'm not that kind of a touchy. My job is to lay the spiritual toolkit at their feet and then say, now go help the next guy. And I expect them to be out there helping the next guy. I want them in the trenches carrying the message. You know, that opens the door for me to have time to carry the message. And the cool thing is, when they're doing the deal, they don't take much time. They'll call up once a week and just check in and say, hey, man, everything's going great. And I'm like, that's awesome. What's going on? And they'll just give you a quick little rundown, you know, or they'll send you a quick text and kind of give you almost like a steal on steal. You know, I'm going to meetings. I talked to my sponsor a couple times a week. They give you kind of an outline that everything's firing on all cylinders, and that's all you need. And you move on. It's like, great. You got a brother out there that you know is carrying the message, doing the deal. You know, and then all of a sudden, my guys will send me an SOS text. They'll be like, you available to talk? SOS. And I'll be like, uh-oh, okay. You know, and then you give them the time that they need when there's something's going on. There's a crisis that they can't seem to get their hands around or something. And then you give them the time. But they don't take a whole lot of time. You know, people are always giving you a hard time going, how many people do you sponsor? I have absolutely no idea how many people call me their sponsor. It's in the hundreds, you know. Some of them I haven't even met, you know. I mean, I have no idea who they are, but they JR came up to me one time and told me about this guy that he'd met at a meeting, and, you know, and he said, who's your sponsor? And the guy said, Dave Fredrickson. So JR calls me up and said, hey, I met this guy, Joe Blow. And I'm like, okay. And he goes, no, I met this guy, Joe Blow. And I'm like, okay. And he's like, well, he told me when I asked him who your sponsor was, it was Dave Fredrickson. And I said, well, tell him that his sponsor wants to meet him and know who the hell he is. No idea. But that's okay by me. If he's listened to a series of my tapes and he feels that connection and I've changed his life, if he wants to call me a sponsor, that's fine. Because the sponsor is the guy that takes you through the steps the first time when you first have your first awakening. That's fine by me. Go carry the message. You know, that's the real important deal is, are you in the trenches carrying the message? The rest of this time, if you're just here to get knowledge so you can sound better on your home group on Thursday night, you're in the wrong place. That's not what this is about. And like that warning I forgot to give you that I told you about yesterday, I've ruined that for you. Because to not be carrying the message now, it's going to sit in your craw and it's going to manifest. It's like gangrene. It just slowly creeps up on you and it starts to hurt. And man, you get sicker. Just sitting around not doing what you know you're supposed to be doing. Because the reason I can speak with such authority on that is I did that for a while and it nearly killed me. But I digress. Cool. Let's keep on moving. All right. The results of a spiritual awakening out of the 12 and 12. A lot of people don't ever look at this, but it's really cool. And look at them. There's 12 of them, right? From 106.3. When a man or woman has a spiritual awakening, the most important meaning of it is that he's now able to, number one, do, feel, and believe that which he could not do before with his unaided strength and resources alone. How's that for a promise? Number two, he has been granted a gift which amounts to a new state of consciousness and being. Number three, he's been set on a path which tells him he's really going somewhere. Four, that life is not a dead end, not something to be endured or mastered. In a very real sense, number five, he's been transformed because he has laid hold of a source of strength which in one way or another he had hitherto denied himself. Number six, he finds himself in possession of a degree of honesty. How much of it? How many people in here have ever struggled with dishonesty? I mean, my gosh, all of us. But we now get a degree of honesty, and the longer you're sober and the more spiritual you are, the less your instant reaction, at least when I was, my instant reaction is always just to lie, because that's how we survive when we're out there using, you know? And over time, as you do the spiritual path, less and less and less do you say it. And when if you do let a whopper slip, you're like, wait a minute, sorry. That sentence, I don't know why I just said that, because that was a bold lie. That didn't ever happen. And then you correct it on the spot, you know? And your ego is okay with that. And people are looking at you like, what? Because they've never seen it. Let's see. Number seven, tolerance. Tolerance is huge for us. Most of us have a short fuse. We walk around in a constant state of irritation and agitation. Number eight, unselfishness. Unselfishness. Remember, selfishness and self-centeredness is what destroys us, right? Number nine, peace of mind. Number 10, love, which he had thought himself quite incapable. And we're talking about love as a choice, not just as an action, but you choose to love the unlovable. That is our job in Alcoholics Anonymous. I learned that because my sponsor, we used to have wet drunks that would come into the meeting, and I'd sit on the front row, and when the guy puked, you cleaned it up. Unselfish love. When he crapped his pants, you took him into the men's room and helped clean him up. We don't get puke on our shoes anymore. It's a gift that's been denied to us. When you get a chance to do that uncharacteristic love, just expecting nothing in return, just because they're another human being who's suffering and you know the way out, what a gift. It's a blessing that should not be missed. And that's one of the reasons I gave you that assignment to go out and meet, you know, people that the waiters and waitresses and pay attention to them. This morning I heard a story about a couple of members of this group that went out and did that. And they thanked the waitress and they told her what a great job she had done. And she looked at them and said, nobody ever does that. And they said she was like walking on cloud nine. And what did it take from them? She served them and they said, thank you for the service. You know, and let her know how much they appreciated her. That's unconditional love. They didn't expect anything in return, and they made her life better. You know? Let's see, where was I? 11, what he has received is a free gift, and yet usually, at least in some small part, 12, he has made himself ready to receive it. Not only do you get the gift, you make yourself ready to receive more gifts, and when you're ready to receive more gifts, God wants to give you so many more gifts than you could ever imagine. You know, Mark used to talk about all the time, you know, if you go to the ocean with a thimble, you're going to walk away with a thimble full of water, right? However the size of the container, you open it up. If you create a huge void for gifts in your life, God will fill it each and every time. It's a beautiful deal, but you got to be in it. It's something you got to participate in. Then I'm going to skip some of these slides because it saves time. It's stuff I've already talked about. You know, the first visit to the man, they're talking about wet drunks. we don't do most of the stuff anymore because we don't get that opportunity. Let's see, what do we got going here? I can't even see what that is up at the top. It's the wrong slide. What does that there say? Here's some of my own personal experiences. All right. What to bring on a 12-step God? Who's doing the 12-step call? God. You're just his representative here on this earth, right? So my sponsor taught me, as long as you don't get drunk on the 12-step call, it's a successful 12-step call. That's the boundary. We always go in pairs. You never go by yourself on a 12-step call. You always bring another person. The other person is the safety, right? So you have to discuss who's going to be the 12-stepper and who's going to be the safety, you know? And if one of the questions I always ask, if the guy says, well, I'll be the safety this time, I'm like, well, do you know how to empty a gun? Critically important, because I've gone on a 12-step call and the guy's got a bottle on this side and he's got a gun on that side. You know, you need to approach him very carefully and make sure you take that gun and then you have to be able to empty the weapon. You know, the safety watches the guy who's the drunk and make sure he doesn't get anywhere near there's a weapon, right? So if the guy says, oh, I need to go get a beer, and wants to go into the kitchen, the safety's in the kitchen before he's there in the kitchen to make sure he doesn't get near a knife. Because people are unpredictable. You never know what they're going to do. The 12-stepper, he's focused on carrying the message to this guy and trying to connect with him, trying to make sure he understands that we know what we're talking about, and we know the way out. He doesn't have time to pay attention to what's in the surroundings. His focus is distraction, right? And so you approach it that way. We don't get very many wet 12-step calls, but the same thing can apply to people that come into the program. I get a newcomer that comes walking through the door. I don't know that guy from Adam, you know, but all that say, hey, do you want to go to the diner for a cup of coffee? And we go to the diner and he gets out of the car. I'm watching his hands because I want to know where his hands are. You know, I live in Texas. I don't go anywhere where I'm not armed. I'm also a federal officer, so I carry guns all over the place. But everybody's got guns in Texas, you know. So when his hand goes under the table, I'm watching to see when that hand comes up to see whether there's anything in his hand. You know, you never know. And sometimes we get very, very sick, and we can get paranoid, especially if they're mixing drugs. So you might be talking to the guy, and he seems nice, and all of a sudden, if you've ever seen it, all of a sudden their personality shifts, and it's like they're a whole completely different person. They start to get paranoid. I've even had a guy look at me in the middle of a conversation. He goes, "Who are you?" I realize he just came out of a blackout. Boom, right in front of me. And I'm like, "Well, you met me at the AA meeting half an hour ago." He's like, "Where was I?" And I said, "AA meeting?" I mean, he had no clue. It was really a cool experience, you know? I talked about my grab-and-go kit. My grab-and-go kit has got a big book in it. It's got a meeting list for the local meetings. It's got 40-gallon garbage bags. You know, before I put that knucklehead in my car, there's going to be a 40-gallon garbage bag that gets tucked over the back seat. So if he's got to go, we grab his head and we shove his entire head into that 40-gallon garbage bag. There's rubber gloves, because if he throws up, that's a caustic substance. You don't know whether he's got hep C or what he's got, you know. So there's rubber gloves. There's hand sanitizer. There's a roll of paper towels in there. There's run the scenario through your mind of what can go wrong, and that's what's in my grab-and-go kit, you know. And there's also, like I said the other day, there's a small pint of vodka in there. And that's because sometimes you need to give them a couple shots to get them to the detox, to get them detoxed, or to the emergency room. Cool. New 12-step call, things to remember. It's about having a spiritual experience. He has to want it for himself. You can't force him into it. We still have to win his confidence, number two. Three, see him when he feels jittery, bad, or depressed. The worse he feels, the better. You want him to have a gift of desperation, and you want to pour some kerosene on that gift of desperation, because you want him feeling so horrible about himself that he's willing to do anything. And then you say, "Oh yeah, well, I know how to make that go away. Come with me. I'll show you." You know, it's really cool. Talk to them about the hopelessness of alcoholism. Outline the program of action. Let them know up front what it's going to take. We're going to sit down and do some inventory work. We're going to write a resentment inventory, a fear inventory. We're going to talk about your past relationships. You know, we're going to help set you on a path that's going to help you. We're going to get rid of the guilt, the shame, and the remorse that you've been carrying all these years. I let them know that up front. I don't want to spring it on them, you know, after I've wasted 2 hours talking to this guy, and he's like, whoa, I ain't talking about any of that. I'm taking that stuff to the grave. I let him know up front. And if he says, "Well, I'm not interested in what you're carrying," I'm like, "Okay, go with God. Where do you want me to drop? Want me to drop you to the liquor store? You know, I'll be happy to do that. Whatever you need, you know." I'll lend him a copy of your big book. I give him a copy of the big book. I don't lend it to him. I'm like, "Here, I want you to have this. It's my gift." What is it, $6.50? Some groups it's up to $8 or something. Just think about how many hundreds of thousands of dollars have I saved in the last almost 4 decades because I'm not in a bar. I can afford to give away a few big books, you know. Ask them to read the big book. And that includes guys that come into the meeting for the first time. They show up at the meeting and you talk to him after the meeting. He walks out of that meeting. I've got his phone number in my phone. I already talked about that. He's walking out with a big book. A lot of people just give him the book. No, you got to ask him. Say, "Hey, I know you might have a lot of going on in your life, but if you really want help and you can't bother to come tonight, and we're so glad you came, would you please read this? I'd like you to read like the first 45 pages is what I usually say. Just read the first 45 pages and then you and I can talk about it tomorrow at the meeting. You know, do you need me to pick you up and bring you to the meeting, or should I meet you at the meeting?" I don't give him an option. I'm leading the guy. "Oh, okay. You know, you can pick me up, I guess." "No, I'll meet you there. I'm like, "Okay, well, here's the meeting." You know, he knows I'm going to call him to make sure he's going to go to the meeting. And then I'm going to test his willingness to see how well is he worthy of my time. If he gives me any kind of excuse, I'm like, "That's okay, not a problem. If you can't make it to the meeting tonight, that's great. You've got my number. You know where I'll be. I'm always at these meetings if I'm in town. You know, go with God, go in peace." And what's it cost me? A big book? 45 minutes of my time? I know I'm not going to get drunk that day. He's given me a gift. You know? Anyway. After he's read the book, we're supposed to offer to do his third and fifth step with him. We're supposed to help him do his third step prayer, and then we're supposed to hear his fifth step when he's written it. He may not want anything else. He does not want you to sponsor him. You know, so I always make sure to follow the program of Alcoholics Anonymous Say, hey, I'm available to help you with your, when you want to turn your will and your life over to God to help you with that. I'd be more than happy to hear your third step prayer or help you write it if that's what you need. I can coach you on that. And I'm available to hear fifth steps. I've heard a lot of them. There's nothing you can say that's going to surprise me. I've heard it all. I just make that offer to him. And he may say, you know what, I don't want this. I'm like, okay, great. Let me know if you change your mind. His recovery is dependent on God. I make that, if I haven't made that clear this weekend, you're in the wrong place. That's just how I 12-step people. I let them know Alcoholics Anonymous is not about not drinking. It's about finding a relationship with a power greater than yourself, period. And he might as well let him know up front, because you spend 2 or 3 hours, that's an investment, and then all of a sudden you mention it and he figures out, wait a minute, this is a God thing? They want nothing to do with it sometimes. I want to let them know up front, that's what got us sober. But you say it in the right way and you'll get them thinking, well, wait a minute, what? You believe in God? Oh yeah, well I believed in God, but now I believe in a different conception because of my experiences here. They showed me things that I never knew existed. I'm like, whoa, now he's kind of might be questioning, going, huh, that sounds interesting. What is this about? But he knows it's about God. emphasize the importance of 10 and 11. Almost immediately, when I'm working with a guy, his homework assignment is, I take him to page 83 and I show him that prayer on page 83, prayer number one, patience, tolerance, kindness, and love. I said, I don't care whether you quit drinking, don't quit drinking, this is for your family, and you'll become a better human being if you do this prayer. And I just say, why don't you just start with that? Get up every morning and say this prayer. Ask God for patience, tolerance, kindness, and love for your wife, your kids, if you're single, for your coworkers, you know. And it's amazing the power of that. Any prayer life at all helps them. It's a miracle to watch how that can affect an individual. Cool. Substitute the fellowship for drinking. I talk to him and find out what his drinking career is. If he's drinking every single day, I said, you know, the big book recommends that you be in contact with alcoholics every single day. If he's a periodic and he only drinks on Friday, Saturday, on weekends, like a lot of professionals, they only drink, they lose their crap on weekends and they call in sick on Monday, so they're really a Friday to Monday drunk. I'm like, well, then on the weekends, you should really be in contact with us. Probably plan on going to a meeting if you're truly serious about staying sober. Because that's what our book says on 152. It says, do we have a sufficient substitute for alcohol? Yeah, it's Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. 12, remind him that he has to place recovery above everything. If he's only there to get his wife back because she just walked out the door, or to get his driver's license back, I'm like, you know what? I'll help you. I'll show you the tools that we're using, but the chances of you staying sober are not really well good. And I'll tell him right to his face. It's probably not going to work for you. Because you're not in any pain. You're just trying to get your wife back, from what I can see. So I'll still help you, but that's not what we're doing here. We're not here about we're all in. It's a whole deal. You know, we're not just about getting the monkey off your back. We're about, we give everything to God, and he gives us back what we're supposed to have, and it all takes care of itself. It's one of the greatest miracles of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they go, oh. They don't understand it. They're like, that makes no sense. And I go, yeah, I know it doesn't make. There's a whole bunch of things that don't make sense. And you'll hear it in the meetings. And you got to surrender to win. You ever heard that one? Oh, yeah. There's all these paradoxes in Alcoholics Anonymous, but they're true, you know. And once he hears a couple of those, he's like, oh, this is really weird. But if he's still willing, remember, willingness is in all 12 steps. You're there to help carry the message. And remember, the results are always up to God. Nothing to do with you. All right. Step 12, 143:1. He should understand that he must undergo a what? Change of heart. Where does the problem reside? In the mind. He has to change his heart. To get over drinking will require a transformation of thought and attitude. I tell him this stuff right up front. This is going to be a revolutionary change in the way you think, the way you act, and especially how you feel about the world and your situation. I know you're feeling like the world sucks, and you know your wife did you wrong, she just walked out on you, and your boss thinks, you know, didn't give you the pay raise, and I know that's, but we're going to change the way we're going to show you how to see that God is working behind that, and it was actually a blessing because it got you here to us. Wow, that's a powerful message. It's not what they usually hear when they walk into their first AA meeting, you know. Oh, we've got a newcomer. Welcome, you know. Everybody claps. And, you know, you're the most important person in the room. Oh man, okay. follow that up with, what does that mean? You know, now the guys who already got an ego problem, and you walked into an AA meeting, now you're saying, you're the most important person in the room. You know, he's a lying drunk, and now his ego just goes, psh! It's like, but I digress. I could talk an hour on that one. Job or no job, wife or no wife, right? We all know that passage. Wonderful. Both you and the new man must walk day by day in the path of spiritual progress. I use this expression with this guy all the time. I look at him, I say, I'm not teaching you anything. I'm just inviting you to come do what I do. You will see that I live transparently. This is what I do. And all the people that I help, I don't say, you need to do A, B, and C. I say, come do this with me. This is what I'm doing. And I will show you, by the way I live, how to stay sober. That's the most effective 12-step call you're going to find on the planet. Because if you're sitting there telling them, how many of us walked into A thinking that we were the smartest person in the room? You know, that's how we're hardwired. We're all ego. It's all about us. Don't you understand? It's about me. You don't understand. I know. I'm smarter than you people. Of course, you just walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, but that's a whole other thing. But it's a matter of perspective. You know, if you're looking for an effective 12-step call, show them what you're doing. Don't tell them what you're doing. And that's the same rule that we judge them by. Brenda talked about it last night in her talk. I'm a footman. I don't care what's coming out of your mouth. I'm looking at your feet. What are your actions? That's going to dictate whether you're worth my time. If I give you, say, hey, read the first 45 pages, when I call them up and say, hey, did you read the first 45 pages? It's like, well, I read to 18. I'm like, okay, I already know this guy is not worthy of my time in his current form. Now, he may be next time we talk, but I'm going to be less, he's not going to be on number one on my list. I'm not going to not talk to somebody else who's actually got showing some valid willingness to talk to this knucklehead. If I can fit him in, I'll fit him in. You know, but he's already demonstrated he doesn't have the willingness that he needs. First principle of success, we should never be angry. We talked about this on several occasions through the workshop, the gratitude list, the purpose of it. Giving rather than getting will become our guiding principle. Powerful spiritual principle. Did you ever ask yourself, what are the spiritual principles we're supposed to practice in all our affairs? Read the lost chapters. Read Two Wives, you know, Family Afterwards, Two Employers, Vision for You, and go through with a highlighter, a weird color, like a purple or something you don't normally highlight with, and highlight every spiritual principle that you can run across through there. And I guarantee you, when you get to the end, you'll be like, wow, that was a lot of them. And if you do that exercise immediately following, you'll find even more that you missed, you blew right past. It's unbelievable how many spiritual principles that we're supposed to be living that we've never, ever focused on. People think, well, the spiritual principles are just the 12 steps. No, there's the 12 steps, there's 12 traditions, there's 12 concepts, there's 6 warranties. I had a lady with like 40-some-odd years walk up to me at a workshop one time, and she's like, I know the 12 steps. I've heard of the 12 traditions. I don't know where you're getting this bullshit about 12 concepts, much less warranties. And she turned around, madder than hell, and walked away. And I'm like, go with God, you know. Happy, joyous, and free. When is it time to rewrite inventory? If you aren't wearing life like a loose garment, if you are not happy, joyous, and free, if you feel like the world owes you something, like somebody's done you wrong, you are not happy, joyous, and free. If you are restless, irritable, and discontent, you are doing something wrong. It's time to sit down with somebody and write. Notice I didn't say get together with your sponsor and have a cup of coffee. It's time to sit down with somebody, two people, and write. Not go off because you got 15 years and you've been through these steps 10 times and you know what you're doing, to go off and write some inventory by yourself and never fifth step it. I see that a lot. I'm like, hey, did you write about it? And I'm like, oh yeah. I'm like, well, who'd you fifth step it with? Well, I haven't yet. Well, geez, I wonder why you're still not happy, joyous, and free. It's a requirement, guys. What are the greatest enemies of alcoholics? Anybody know? There we go. Greatest enemies of alcoholics. Resentment. Jealousy. Envy. Frustration. And fear. When was the last time you were frustrated? Yeah. Right? I have 5 or 6 bouts every day, I guarantee it. And I don't look at that as an enemy. But that's a threat to my sobriety. That's a normal feeling for me. It's like I kind of get off on having a little agitation, especially when I'm driving. That's a in all my years of being around this program, that's one area I fail at consistently, is my driving. I just haven't figured out how to crack that nut because I get behind the wheel. Now, I'm driving with JR the other day, and JR, he's a professional driver, and I was sitting there, and he doesn't even know this. I've never mentioned this to him. I was friggin' in awe because people are driving like idiots, and JR is just sitting there just kind of cruising along. And he couldn't have given a crap, you know, and he was peaceful and serene, and Carlene kept pointing at me going, that's only because you were sitting in the back seat. But I was just I was like slack-jawed. Oh, I can't believe that guy cut you off and you didn't do anything about it. I mean, maybe, I have some spiritual growth in that area still. We already talked about substitute for alcohol. Self-reliance. Is that up on the screen? There it is, yep. God will determine that, so you must remember that your real reliance is always upon Him. How often?
Always.
I get this on a regular basis. He will show you how to create the fellowship you crave. I get calls. I bet you I get 3 calls a month and an email at least a week from people saying, there's no good AA here. I don't know what to do. Can you help me? And I'm like, have you talked to God about it? Do you have a big book? Do you have any of the workshops that I've ever produced? You must, because you got my email address from someplace. You have a book, you've got the information, create the fellowship you crave. Start a group, get some friends, meet some people that have willingness. Well, I live in a dark tunnel area, there are no people that want to do this work. And I said, great, then every single newcomer that comes in for the next month, I want you to grab them and 12-step them, every single one of them, and invite them to create a group with you. And you start with 8 newbies and you will create what you crave. And those guys will start to infect the other AA groups in the area, and before you know it, people will start changing. Just ask Cody. I took Cody through the work, and another guy, Brad, up in Seattle, and the next thing you know, people are like, what are you guys sharing about in the meetings? And the old-timers are looking at him like, what are you guys doing differently? And they're getting the hairy eyeball in the meetings, but they're grabbing all the newcomers, and they're 12-stepping them, and they're carrying them through, and now they got a steel-on-steel group, and people are starting to see, wow, there's some real value here. And they're infecting Alcoholics Anonymous in Seattle with the real message. The program is coming alive again. That's a pocket of enthusiasm. That's what we're after. You can create what you crave, but you have to be willing. What do I got here? Vision for you. We read that at almost every single meeting. I'm not going to take the time to cover that. Cool. What do I got up on the screen? Traditions, relationships? Can you read that? Is that what's up there? Is that traditions, relationships? Cool. That's pretty much the 12 steps. As you guys know, I could talk for all week on the subject of the 12 steps and go deeper and deeper and deeper. I gave you guys a very fast run through. Like I said, there's some other principles that we don't normally apply. And there's the 12 traditions, the 12 concepts, the 6 warranties. And one of the things that I did was I heard a series of recordings by a lady, Mary Pearl Thompson from Texas. And she did a talk on applying the traditions to your relationship. And it had a profound effect on me. I was probably 15 years sober, and when I heard the talk, and I think she's long dead now. I don't think she's still alive, but she was hilarious, and she was an Al-Anon. She wasn't an AA. And her husband was the drunk, and if you've never heard her talk, I highly recommend you get a copy of Mary Pearl Thompson, you know, because she talks about her husband being drunk, and she puts him in the bathtub, and you know, and it's like the 15th time she's had to try to wet nurse this bloody drunk, and the tub is filling up with water, and she watches him slide underneath the water, and she's just watching the bubbles come up, and she's going, do I pull him up? It's the most hilarious talk. It's hilarious. She's just a hoot. But anyway, she gave me this concept, this idea, and so I took it home, and I talked to my wife about it, and so I took the traditions for relationships and made it personal for us. So I'll just read them. Our common welfare should come first. A healthy relationship depends upon unity. 2, for our family or relationship purposes, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself, and our informed family conscience. Each member of is God's trusted servants, and no one governs. Just because I'm the father in the household, I am not the head of the household. They can vote me out anytime they want. 3, 2 or more persons when gathered together for mutual benefit may call themselves a relationship. The only basic requirements for a good marriage or relationship are mutual desire to be in the relationship, a willingness to make the relationship work, and an honest desire to live God's will. 4, each partner should be autonomous except in matters affecting the other partner, the family, or society as a whole. 5, each marriage or relationship has but one primary purpose, to serve as an expression of God's love. 6, a partner ought not be overly supportive spiritually, emotionally, or physically to the marriage or relationship, lest problems of ego or gratification divert us from the primary purpose. That's an important one. Most of us are unequally yoked in our relationships. Typically, it's our spouse, the codependent, who's carrying the lion's share of the load, which allows us to go to A meetings and stuff, but we're kind of hanging out in AA, and they're carrying the work. They're taking care of the kids. They're doing all this other stuff. It's supposed to be equally yoked. We're supposed to be bringing these principles home and being an effective partner. 7, each partner ought to strive to be fully self-supporting, physically, emotionally, and spiritually. Interesting. 8, our marriage or relationship should remain forever free, giving relationship, one to the other. In a healthy relationship, we do not keep score. Scorekeeping is unbelievably devastating to a relationship. 9, a family or relationship should be pliable in its organization, but our group conscience may appoint certain persons to serve in various functions and to be directly responsible to those that they serve. Right now, my wife is in charge of the finance committee. That's her committee. She can do whatever the hell she wants. You know, that's her committee. I don't get involved with that. I know what's going on. We have a prudent reserve and we talk about that stuff, but that's her deal. I don't micromanage. You know, unless there's some kind of a problem. She came to me a week ago, 10 days ago or something, and said there was a calculation error somewhere. She's like, I don't know. I know the money's here. I just don't know what account it's in. You know, and we had a little conversation. My response was, well, figure it out. Whatever you want to do, it's okay with me. That's her business. I don't have to worry about that. 10, a relationship should avoid heated controversy. 11, each partner best conveys his or her beliefs and philosophies by attraction rather than promotion. Anonymity is a value asset to the marriage or relationship. I don't have the right to go out and let my name be used anywhere, any place, because that might have effect on my kids. You know, I may be sitting in an A meeting and there might be other parents that are there that their kids and my kids play together. So I have to be very careful on how I present myself to the world, because I don't care about my anonymity, but maybe they do. And so a lot of times I ask their permission. Hey, can you mind if I go do this? There might be people, or like when I'm in the airline business, my son's now in the military and he's flying airplanes. He's decided to follow the family tradition and he's a pilot. You know, well, I helped set up the drug and alcohol program in the Air Force. You know, that can have some blowback on him. People know my name. So it's like, are you okay with this? What's going on? He needs to know what he's up against, because my anonymity has an effect on his anonymity. Does that make sense? Cool. Anonymity expressed through selflessness is the spiritual foundation of our life as marriage, friends, partners, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities, and the main principle in a loving relationship is unselfishness. Our greatest expression of love is to be of help to one another, and we can't do that if we are selfish. One of the questions I always ask guys who call me up that have relationship issues is, do you know what the purpose of marriage is? Does anybody in here know what the purpose of marriage is? Not a single hand? Let me tell you what the purpose of marriage is. The purpose of marriage, and I'm being dead serious, is to kill you. I'm serious. The death of self. You cannot be in a marriage and be selfish. The whole purpose of it, a healthy, happy marriage, is when you have two people who love each other and each one is trying to be selfless more than the other one. And because they're being selfless to you, you want to be more selfless and loving to them, and you're sacrificing for them, and they're busy sacrificing for you, and the relationship just gets more and more together, and you become bonded, and the two become one flesh. Because your concern is about the other person. It's not about self. It's not about what you get. There's no scorekeeping, and it's all about love and service, which is an expression of God, love and service. It's the expression of Alcoholics Anonymous, love and service, right? And you overlook anything that's bad. You have tolerance for each other. You have patience, you have kindness, and it's an upward spiral. When you keep score and everything else, it becomes a downward spiral. When you're only doing your share, but well, I'm not going to do that, but I always have to empty the dishwasher, and it becomes a downward spiral. Your relationship can be an upward spiral or a downward spiral. Your call. But I mean it from the bottom of my heart. The purpose of a marriage is to kill you. And if you focus on that meditation, it will profoundly affect your relationship. Brenda was... she was talking about that period in our life. That time period was when I had my broken back, and I was in excruciating pain. And I would sometimes thank God for POW school from the military, because I would sit there sometimes and just watch the second hand on the clock and say, I'm not going to kill myself for one more minute. It was brutal. And I was praying to God, remove this pain. And I was meditating and trying to focus on getting the pain to go. And my wife wanted me to be a husband. I had nothing to give. And she was afraid. And she was feeling the pain, and she could feel me detaching. And I don't think she fully comprehended how much I was just trying to stay alive. It was survival. I think it finally came clear to her when we went to a marriage counselor, and in the middle of the marriage counseling, we were talking about our son who's got the Lyme disease, and the counselor looked at me and said, you seem disengaged. And I said, I am. I said, I don't give a shit about what happens with him or my marriage. I'm just trying to stay alive. And the counselor got this look on her face like, what? And I said, you don't get it. And she didn't get it. The counselor didn't get it. My wife didn't get it. I was just trying to get from one day to the next. But then I started getting better. And the nerves started to heal. And God freed me from that. And the meditation started to work. And I could meditate through the pain. And then it hit me. Purpose of marriage is to kill me. And so I changed my attitude from... I was completely selfish at that point, trying to survive. It was all about me. And then I flipped the switch and said, you know what? It's got to be all about her and the family. And I became a different man. I became Dave 2.0 or 5.0 or whatever. I was a whole new version. And my whole spirituality shifted. And I remember talking with JR on the phone saying, I don't know what's going on here, but I'm just changing some things. And he's like, well, let's see where this goes. And, you know, one of the cool things about JR is I'll throw an idea at him and he'll say, well, let me sit with that for a while. And it may be 2 weeks later and he'll call me up and say, you know, I've been sitting with that thing. And he'll report back to me what came to him and from God. And it was life changing. But my life doesn't belong to me. My marriage does not belong to me. I'm a willing participant in that marriage, and it's all about sacrifice. You know, and so I changed everything. And as you heard, the results are proving for themselves. And it didn't really click for me until I started to teach it. You know, in the medical field, they say, see one, do one, teach one. That's how you learn to become a doctor or a nurse or whatever. You see them do it once, and then they have you do it once, and then you have to teach somebody how to do it once, and by that point, you got it. Boom. So I saw it because I had a front row seat to trying to work on it. I guinea pigged on myself. And like JR was talking about, we always guinea pig our sponsees. So we'll have these conversations. I said, well, let's give this a shot. You do it with your guys, and I'll do it with my guys, and we'll see how it works out. And so I started guinea pigging this with guys, and guys whose wives are walking out the door, and all of a sudden they're like, I don't know what you're doing with my husband, man. Don't stop doing it. Because this is what I'm teaching. I'm teaching guys how to be selfless in their marriage. It makes a huge difference, you know, ginormous. The 12 concepts in the 12 traditions. I did the exact same thing for the 12 concepts that I described here. And I'll go through them really fast because most people don't even know what the concepts are. And, you know, and what I did was I put the date that's in here was the date of my marriage. So the final responsibility and ultimate authority for the family should always reside in the collective conscience of our whole family. When in 1988 this family was formed, they thereby delegated complete authority for the active maintenance of the family to all of its trusted servants, excepting for any change in the 12 traditions or to the family structure due to a change in the number of its members. The family members may make up the actual voice and the effective conscience of the whole family. In other words, the family unit changes. Like right now, my kids are out of the house. So our family unit has changed. So it's been reconstituted under the concepts that the God speaking through the group conscience, we have a group conscience when it's just my wife and I. You know, when the kids come back, you know, one of the kids comes home from college, now all of a sudden the group conscience has changed because we've allowed that flexibility. Does that make sense under the concept? Cool. As a traditional means of creating and maintaining a clearly defined working relationship between the family members and the trusted servants, thus ensuring the effective leadership, it is here suggested that we endow each of the elements of the family with the traditional right of decision. She's running the finance committee. She has the right of decision. She wants to go change the telephone company. She can go change the telephone company. The other day, she changed the electric company. Now, she said, hey, I'm going to be changing over from Encore over to this other electric company and save 3 cents a kilowatt hour. And I'm like, okay. She has the right of decision. She doesn't have to come get my permission. That's her committee. Does that make sense? When you have that committee. I have the garbage committee. You know? That's part of my committee. You know? It's my responsibility to make sure the cans get out to the curb on the correct day. And when there's a holiday, it's not that on a Tuesday, it's on a Wednesday. They pick up a day later. And then it's also my job to make sure I get those cans back in. Jared, what do we got?
Would you say a phrase that's accurate to this is the right of decision?
The right of decision, exactly. It's the right of decision. You have the right of decision to run the committee. You know, and sometimes she'll look at me and go, well, are you going to put out the recycling? And what I'm hearing in my head is, that's my damn committee. Stay out of my way. And I'll go, I got it, is what I normally say. I'll say, no, I got it. You know, because she'll start piling boxes up in the garage and it gets kind of unwielding in there. But I've got a plan, you know, but it's my committee. I'll run it how I see fit. You know, hey, it's a privilege to run a garbage committee. Four, throughout the family structure, we ought to maintain at all responsible levels of tradition, right of participation, taking care that each classification or group of trusted servants shall be allowed a voting representation in reasonable proportion to the responsibility that each must discharge. You have a right to participate because you're a family member. You get a vote. We don't do, you know, when we were little, kids were little, we wouldn't do, you know, because mommy and daddy say so. Uh-uh. They're members of the family, so they get a right to vote. So we would say, okay, it really sounds really crazy, but it, you know, we have these little kids. I make a motion. Okay, we have a motion on the floor. What's the motion? The motion is we go out and get some ice cream. Okay, we have a motion. Do we have a second for that? Of course, the two kids would always, I second that. Okay, we take a vote. And whatever the group conscience would be, that's what we would do. Now, I'd get home from a three-day trip. You know, I got in at 5 o'clock in the morning. I'm friggin' exhausted. I'd get an hour nap. I'd wake up. I'd be kind of stumbling around, and I'd hear one of those motions, and I do not want to go get ice cream. But I'd get outvoted 3-1, and I'd be like, okay, we're going to get ice cream. Group conscience spoke. God spoke through the group conscience. Out we'd go. That's the way it goes. I could have been a horse's ass and said, no, I'm not going. I'm tired. You know? But if you want to be part of the group, you do what the group says. That's what this deal is about, practicing these principles in all our affairs.
Yeah, Dave, can I make a point?
Yeah, come on up here and make the point.
This what Dave's talking about here about the group conscience, was one of the things that Dave and I had the opportunity to wake up the
Russia.
General Service Conference in Russia about. Because at the time we were there the Alcoholics Anonymous had only been allowed in that country legally for like 25 years, 27 years, something like that, when we were there. Over the course of that period of time, there were the same people were in charge. There was no spirit of rotation. Mm-hmm. And we brought that to them. We explained to them that the spirit of rotation was something that had worked in the United States with Alcoholics Anonymous, and they were totally oblivious to it. The old bleeding deacons who had been running and calling all the shots in Alcoholics Anonymous for years wanted to hang Dave and I.
They were not happy.
Because the newer people in the general service structure became active when they heard that. The other thing about the group conscience that I feel is very important for people to know is that the group conscience that we see oftentimes today is simply a vote. You know, how do you feel about it? The group conscience the group conscience that was originally used in Alcoholics Anonymous came from the Oxford group. And what they would do is that they would have a decision to make, and they wouldn't know exactly what decision to make. They would take time and they would say, pray about it. You know, each individual would pray about it, and then they would take quiet time. And they would sit quietly to receive God's message. You see, God is the ultimate authority. So they would receive God's message. Then they would reconvene the meeting and have, for lack of a better term, a vote that came out of the group conscience as it came from God. during their quiet time. Now, the people in Russia didn't know anything about that. They were having, you know, trying to have a vote, and they were to a point where their discussions were just a big argument. they weren't getting anywhere. And they came to and told Dave and I that after their first day of their conference at dinner. I can remember sitting in that room. Remember the dancing?
Oh, absolutely.
They did that Russian down one leg thing. Yeah. But
come on, show us.
I digress. Nonetheless, at this dinner, they told us about that. And so that night, Dave and I, you know, we looked at each other and we said, hell, you know, they don't understand the group conscience. So that night, during our session, we explained to them where the group conscience came from and how the group conscience used to work and how it still works if you use it. The next day they had their general service conference, and that night at dinner, Dave and I both were amazed at the number of people who approached us and said, hey, you know what? You know, today we actually made some progress. We took group consciences the way that you guys have described it, and we had amazing success. So I think it's important to realize what a group conscience really is and where it's supposed to come from. You know, and not just a simple vote from our mind. See, when we take that time and we develop a vision, it gives us the opportunity to come from the trash pile into the deepest part of our being, or what's supposed to be the deepest part. So I digress.
That's some deep water there, brother.
You know, the deepest part of us is supposed to be in our chest. That's where our heart is. The reason it's there is to be protected. It gets us out of our mind and into our heart. Is there a question?
Yeah, I was going to say, now that it's just you and Bryn, how do you do the tiebreaker?
How do we do the tiebreaker? If it's very rarely that we do have a loggerhead, then you postpone and let God speak to your heart. Take it in prayer and meditation. We pray about it. We'll hold hands. We'll talk about it. Or we kick the can down the road. What? Oh, well, I was going to get to that on the next section, but one of the things my wife just whispered to me is when we go to make decisions and there's a loggerhead, the rule we use is two yeses or one no. So we both have to say yes. If either party says no, it's no. You know, and there's been a couple deals about that. Like the move to Texas was, she's like, I want to move. She didn't care where it was. I just want to get out of New Jersey. I want to move. And I was a no. And so it was one yes and one no. We didn't move. And all of a sudden, you know, I told that story. All of a sudden I became a yes, and she was madder than hell. She's like, what? Somebody just calls you on the phone and all of a sudden you're a yes? I've been asking for 10 years to move. She's going through that now. She's been asking me to move for about the last 5 or 6 years. And I'm like, no, God hasn't told me to move. And it's pissing her off. And she's kind of gotten even with me because now she's like, well, if I'm going to have to live in this house for the rest of my life, I want new floors. I want a painter to come. I want new cabinets. You know? And I'm like, okay, I'll agree to that. You know, you're in charge of the financial budget. You got the prudent reserve. Figure it out. And she has. God bless her. Let me run through this real quick. We'll take a quick break. I think it was up to 6. On behalf of the family, the trusted servants have the principal responsibility for the maintenance of the family, and the collective voice of all family members traditionally has the final decision respecting large matters of general policy and finance. But the family also recognizes that chief initiative and active responsibility in the most of these matters should be exercised primarily by the parental trustees when they act amongst themselves as the parental service board for the family. In other words, you give the kids a vote, but if there's something really important, you know, the parental service board makes the decision for the family, because there's some things you really shouldn't be giving kids the decision making, you know, on who's going to be the guardians for the kids if you die. You know, they're going to want Uncle Joe because he's a fun bunch of fun, but Uncle Joe's a pothead. You know, that's probably not a good decision. 7, the family recognizes that the vows exchanged by the parental trustees created a legal entity and thereby fully empowered the parental service board to manage and conduct all of the family affairs. It is further understood that the concepts are spiritual, not legal instruments, and that the family itself is a spiritual body, that it relies instead upon God, as he may express himself in the group conscience. The principal vows of love, honor, and cherish each other, the force of tradition, self-sacrifice, selflessness, cooperation, and as a last resort, the power of the parental purse for its final effectiveness. Right? We're not going to violate the financial rules. So if somebody wants to go take a $20,000 river cruise in Europe and we got no prudent reserve, if nothing else, the parental purse will control. You know, even though one person is like, man, I really think that I want to go do this, you know, you follow the rules. The parental trustees, which make up the parental service board, act in two primary capacities. With respect to large matters and overall policy and finance, they are principal planners and administrators. They and their primary committees directly manage these affairs. But with respect to the consistently active service committees, the relationship of the parental service board is mainly that of custodial oversight, which they exercise through their ability to elect all directors of the family service committees. In other words, Brenda's the service, the financial committee right now. There's going to be some rotation, and that's going to be part of the system, you know, but while she's doing it, she's doing it. And she has the right of decision, the right of participation. She can make the plans, you know, but the minority opinion always gets heard. So even though there's a minority opinion, we still put that on, and they get an equal vote, and they get the second time for a tiebreaker. Good service leaders, together with a sound method of choosing them, are at all levels indispensable for our future functioning and safety. The primary family relationship must necessarily be assumed by the parental trustees who make up the parental service board. 10. Every service responsibility should be matched with an equal service authority. The scope of such authority is always to be well defined, either by tradition, by resolution, or by specific job description. If there's any question, put it in writing. This is what your responsibilities are to run the trash committee. And you can put it down. Take the garbage cans out, bring the garbage cans in, whatever it happens to be. And, you know, so there's no misunderstanding. We have that with our kids. When there's something in question, we'll write it down. You know, when my kids got their driver's licenses, we wrote out a contract. Here is the contract. And but here's the most important thing. We wrote in the consequences if the contract was violated. You know, one of the consequences was losing your driving privileges for a year. You know, they're not allowed to use cell phones. They're not allowed to change the radio station. More kids die by texting or trying to change the radio station, and they're not used to driving. They get distracted, and they hit head-on. So my kids were not allowed to do that. They weren't allowed to drive with other people in the car. They could drive with each other. The two boys could be in there with one other friend. But the parent had to know who the friend was that was in the car. You know, our younger son was driving the car, and he went to reach for his cell phone that he should have been playing with, and it fell on the floor, and he, you know, did a lot of damage to the car. And I looked at him, and he came walking through the house. He goes, Dad, I really screwed up. And I said, you know the penalty. Since it was already in the contract, I didn't have to say another word. He's like, yep. He already knew he'd lost his driving privileges for a year. He never complained. There was no argument. There was no discussion, because it was written in the contract. While the parental trustees hold the final responsibility for family administration, they should always have the assistance of the best possible standing committees, staffs, and consultants. Therefore, the composition of these underlying committees, the personal qualifications of the members, the manner of their introduction into service, the system, their rotation, the way in which they are related to each other, their specific rights, duties, together with the proper basis for the financial compensation of these workers, will always be a matter of serious care and concern. The way we work our family is any money that comes into the family, doesn't matter where it comes from, goes into one pot. Out of that pot, everybody gets an allowance. That's your money to do with what you want. So if I want to buy my wife a wedding present or a wedding present, a anniversary gift or a birthday present or something, I've got a pot of money there that she knows nothing about, so I can surprise her. If she's running the financial committee and she sees it come across on a credit card, she knows that I've gotten her whatever and what I've paid for it, and I don't want that. So everybody gets their own pot of money. Then there's a vacation account and a savings account and something I call a black hole account. Money only goes in and never comes out. It's the absolute emergency fund. There's an automotive account. There's all these sub-accounts. You know, we run it like a business, and it solves the issue. There's no issue. Everybody knows that you get your allowance, and that's what you live on. You know, and if you mismanage it, that's on you. Sorry. Good luck with that. And it's non-negotiable. There's no problem with it. It works perfectly well. Lastly, general warranties of the family. In all proceedings, the family should observe the spirit of a tradition, taking great care that the trusted servants and committees never become the seat of perilous wealth or power, that sufficient operating funds plus an ample reserve be its prudent financial principle, that none of the family members shall ever be placed in a position of unqualified authority over any of the others, that as important decisions shall be reached by discussion, vote, and whenever possible, by substantial unanimity, that no family actions ever be personally punitive or an incitement to public controversy, that though the trusted servants may act for the service of the family, they shall never perform acts of government, and that like the family itself, which they serve, the trusted servants will always remain democratic in thought and action. You know, on traditional 11, where it talks about having the best possible people for the committees, neither of us are attorneys. So if we have something like we need our wills redone, we go get somebody to write the wills. We get a professional to do that. You know, we get professionals wherever it's possible to do it. If there's something that's that important, you want to make somebody that's all they do for a living. You know, when we go to a doctor, we can go to a doctor that's in our plan, but if there's something wrong with one of us, we go to the best of the best, even if they're outside of our plan. We get the best advice. We get spiritual advice. We have spiritual advisors. We have sponsors. You know, we make sure that the family has the tools necessary to succeed. It's critically important. Why don't we take a quick break and come back? Is 5 minutes enough to smoke? Let's come back at quarter after. That's